Okay, so this is our ninth class on Deuteronomy. We'll be looking tonight at chapters 20 and 21. I'm expecting for the next several weeks we'll be working with two chapters per night. Several times it's obvious I try to take on too much, I think, and just going much too fast. But we'll try to look at two chapters each night here for a little while. And before we do, though, tonight, I hope you'll pardon me, but I have, or at least permit me, I've been feeling kind of nostalgic, I guess, this week, because we are now 7 years and 2 days past the first Sunday that I was the preacher here. So the very first time that I began full-time preaching was on the 15th of July, exactly 7 years ago. And so this is what I looked like then. We were staying at the D'Ambrosias. Okay, so that should look familiar to you guys. You can see that it was the last moment on a Sunday morning as I was still preparing, you know, for the presentation there. But then we began what I think has been a very productive and enjoyable 7 years together. And since tonight, particularly with just the two chapters, we're also going to have a little bit of time, I thought, if you wouldn't mind, I hope you won't mind anyway, that I would review very quickly that sermon. So I brought the slides from Sunday morning 7 years ago. I was stunned myself to see that apparently I was into that white dove I've been using on Sunday nights as we've been studying the Holy Spirit, you know, 7 years ago. Didn't realize that welcome slide, you know, had that same artwork on it. But what I led off with 7 years ago were these thoughts. Life is, in fact, often extremely turbulent and fearful. We have had two deaths in our Christian family in just this last week. One here, you know, in this congregation, of course, the loss of Olin Hudson as well. And so it is one of the more common, not problems, but observations, and for a lot of people, sometimes problems, to want to know why. You know, what is it that causes life to be this difficult? These were the prayer requests exactly 7 years and 2 days ago. You'll notice as you read down through there that six of these people are no longer with us. Like Millie, they have gone on to an eternal reward. We have every confidence and faith that their faith was everything that God would have it be, that their faith had been joined with works. But on that morning, 7 years ago, this was our prayer list at that time. And then I began to address the question, you know, why does it have to be so hard? And not that I'm complaining about it or anybody else either, but just the, you know, the academic question. Life is tough. Why is that so? So we spent some time in Genesis chapter 3, verses 17 through 19, the first verse of which says, "Cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you'll eat of it all the days of your life." Well, from Genesis 3, we should be expecting that life is more difficult than we could see that it might be. And it used to be better for some unknown period of time in the garden. But now, and for millenniums, it has been more difficult. And it's been cursed, the very earth, because of the entrance of sin into the world. We have all chosen to sin. We all bear that responsibility. So when we're wondering why things are so hard, it's one of those deals, you know, where look in the mirror or point the finger at yourself. We've participated in sin. We share some degree of responsibility for the circumstances out there. Then, you know, the people that are in it suffer, but also are the cause of a lot of suffering, primarily because, and I'm sorry about the text there, I would only learn later that I needed to get bigger print if I wanted everybody to see it. But in John 12, 4, and also in 14, 2 Corinthians 4, Revelation 12, and then in Ephesians 2, my point was just to pick out all of these passages that deal with, as John 12 says, the ruler of this world. He has nothing in Jesus. He's the God of this world. He blinds the minds of the unbelieving. He is the serpent of old who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world in Revelation chapter 12 and in verse 9. So once again, we ought not to be so surprised. God does, in fact, though we don't care for that reality, allow Satan to have influence in the world today. One day that influence will end completely. But still, the great deceiver, the father of lies, the murderer from the beginning, he is among us. He is tempting us. He is working everywhere in all the world. So why is it so difficult? Well, it's difficult because we have a great and terrible adversary who walks around like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Often, though, we wonder, well, why should the saints suffer? We are the people that have turned ourselves back to our God. We are seeking to ignore Satan, to defy Satan, to defeat Satan. So, though, in 1 Peter 4, and this is very specifically rooted in its time frame, so I understand they're living in the time of the Great Tribulation that Jesus talked about in Matthew 24. But still, in general, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory, you may rejoice with exultation. Now, I pointed out then, I point out again, you know, we want to be careful when we're looking at this, brethren, that we don't confuse this with Genesis that we looked at earlier, the passages about Satan, which apply to the condition of the entire world. This says you shouldn't be surprised at fiery ordeals when you share the sufferings of Christ. This is limited to only those kinds of agonies and sufferings and persecutions and problems we have that arise solely because of the fact that the world sees we are Christians and responds with anger. That's very different than just being a human being living on a world that's been cursed. So then I pointed out, of course, that the kingdom of heaven, and we just coincidentally studied this not long ago from Matthew chapter 13, that the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant man seeking goodly pearls who, when he found one of great price, went and sold all that he had, and he bought it. So in the midst of all this trouble, there still is always truth. There still is always God's divine wisdom presented on how to handle our problems. There is still always the hope of eternal life. So we have a counterbalance to this difficult world that we're living in, but it's going to remain a difficult world. Then in 2 Peter chapter 3, Paul, according to the wisdom given him, wrote to you, as in all his letters, speaking in them of these things, in which are some things hard to understand, which the untaught and unstable distort, as they do also the rest of scriptures, to their own destruction. So, brethren, even in the church, there's going to be difficulties. Paul warned about wolves in sheep's clothing. There's going to be, false teachers and false messiahs. And so we should expect, because the Bible is full of these admonitions, that life is going to be tough. And don't be surprised by it. Remember this from James chapter 1, verses 2 through 4. We should be considering it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. So James tells us at the very first words in his epistle, as he's led by the Spirit to reveal it, that yeah, the world is tough. But our response as wise ones, guided by the instructions of our God, is to recognize that these various trials, for whatever reason, whether it's just because you're a human being living in a cursed world, or because you're a very faithful saint who is getting that opposition from the world, this faith produces endurance. The endurance has a perfect result, that you may be perfect and complete and lacking in nothing. Well, ultimately, these difficulties, what makes life hard, has a very positive aspect as well. And then I just ask the simple question. When you think about the lives of Adam and Eve, who had to experience a fallen world utterly unprepared and walking out of the garden with the animal skins God had put on them to figure out how they were going to make a living on the earth now. When you think about Job tortured the way that he was, you think about Abraham, who never owned a square foot of land in what had been promised would be his own nation's land. When you think of Moses and all the agonies he suffered at the hands of the murmuring, you know, saints of old. When you think of Joshua and the battles that he had to spend his whole life trying to conquer, you know, the promised land so they could live in freedom. When you think of the life of Joseph, we studied in such detail on Sunday nights now, not long ago. When you think of David, who, because of a terrible sin, you know, would have the sword hanging over his house, you know, for his entire life. When you think about all the prophets who were told to look toward as examples in the lives of the apostles and the lives of the saints, and, you know, my question is, really? What's so hard about what we're doing? It's kind of pathetic, isn't it, that we would complain? What have we got to complain about? Look what these people went through. And often enough, certainly starting with Job at least and going on down, Adam and Eve got what they deserved, but, you know, from Job on down, much of the time these people had not deserved what was falling upon them. And it was far worse than anything we go through. Really, is our life so tough, considering what Jesus had to go through to rescue us from what we deserved? That's what we deserve. So what you have is not all that hard now, is it? I close with 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation. The temptation stays in place. And with it, He'll provide the way of escape also, so that you'll be able to endure it. That way of escape may not come for days, months, years, decades, but it's there. You know, God is allowing you to suffer these things. He is also perfecting you because of them and limiting everything you experience only to that which is common, therefore normal, but also not beyond what you are able. So, it's just, you know, I've had a week of just thinking about it. You know, it's been 7 years, and so it's been on my mind. That's how it all began. And, you know, brethren, I can't help but think there's nothing new under the sun, right? Because you can preach this sermon any day of the week. You can preach it to any congregation on the planet. You can preach it, you know, to any time frame that there is, because this is the foundation of the world we live in. It is a fallen world. Life is going to be tougher than it would have been if Adam and Eve had not sinned, or their children, or their children, and all the children up to you and your children. So if we hadn't done all this, you know, none of us would be experiencing any of this, but we are. And so, in Deuteronomy chapter 20, are things pretty tough for these folks? They have sinned, and they spent 40 years in the wilderness paying for it. Their fathers and mothers had sinned, and they all died in the wilderness because of it. And now, having fought quite a few battles, Og and Sihon, and further north, they now have come back down south. They have come out of the mountains. They're at the very foot of Mount Nebo, where Moses has observed the width and breadth of this land flowing with milk and honey. And for one last time, over the course of a few days or perhaps weeks, Moses will stand and he will recite the law to them in this great book of Deuteronomy. So I'm going to be doing the very same thing, I think, as I have done the last couple of weeks. I'm just going to keep that going. You don't need a bunch of pictures and all of that for the material that we're going through. We are now in the last part of the book, as I've said, where we've got a lot of these kind of miscellaneous laws that we're talking about. So I'm just going to each time put the chapter breakdown on the screen for you. You can go ahead then, as I have done, mark your Bible. The first 9 verses of chapter 20 are about preparing for battle. And chapter 20's verses 10 to the end, verse 20, are the rules of engagement for these battles. They've fought a handful of them, probably half a dozen or a dozen, very recently. But now they're going in to take an entire promised land. So here now, as we are past the halfway point, there's only 34 chapters in the book, As we're well past the halfway point, nearly two-thirds of the way through the book, Moses now is led to prepare these people for battle. Life might be pretty, meager there on the plains of Moab, as it is to this day. They are mostly barren plains. There is the Dead Sea. You got to catch your water coming out of the Jordan before it hits the Dead Sea, because it's sure enough undrinkable after that. They are in a location that's pretty well hot year-round and can soar up to 125 degrees in the wintertime, or in the summertime, rather. So things have been tough, but they're going to get tougher. They're going to cross the Jordan, and it's going to be battle after battle after battle. They're not going to win them all either. There's going to be a lot of people lose their lives, and eventually they're going to conquer this land. Here is how God prepares them for that battle, beginning with the first four verses in chapter 20. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see horses and chariots and people more numerous than you, do not be afraid of them. For Yahweh your God, who brought you up from the land of Egypt, is with you. Now it shall come about that when you are approaching the battle, the priest shall come near and speak to the people, and he shall say to them, "Hear, O Israel, you are approaching the battle against your enemies today. Do not be faint-hearted. Do not be afraid or panic or tremble before them. For Yahweh your God is the one who goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." Now, brethren, they should have known this 40 years ago when they left Egypt and the first army that got after them showed up, led by Pharaoh. They had their problems back then. They've had their problems since, I'm sure, one confrontation after another. They're not allowed to so much as tremble. God is with you. He is fighting the battle for you. I told you you're going to win. You will win. All I'm asking is that you just go and fight. Now verses 5 through 7. The officers also shall speak to the people, saying, "Who is the man that has built a new house and has not dedicated it? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man dedicate it." That's interesting, and we're going to see this refrain now a couple of times, three times. Another man, another man. Please note, however, much in keeping with what we just read in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, is everybody going to survive every battle whether they do exactly what God wants them to do or not? No. So, if you build a house, you haven't been able to move in yet, it needs to have that blessing procedure, they went through before they move in. Good idea for us today too, I think, be, wise. Often I've seen church buildings dedicated, in this manner. But, that would really be terrible, and I don't want it to happen, God says. So, go on home, dedicate your house, and take care of that. Now, bear in mind, brethren, they're going to be fighting for years. So, they will have intermittent times when they'll go home and they'll be building. And each time, though, if you're in the middle of construction, I'm going to let you finish it. So, only the guys that, are well settled and can leave their families behind in the house, that gives them shelter and comfort and peace, then, those guys will go to battle. But, I'm not going to leave some poor family, in half a house and still living in, the tent or some temporary structure while they're building, that sort of thing. Not going to leave them exposed to the elements. So you guys go on home. This is just merciful. This is just wise. Do we see any of that in our own armed forces? Not really, except what? They do have, there's a special word, what is it? Hardship. Any soldier can always apply, for exemptions based on a hardship. So if something arises, somebody dies, child has got a terminal disease or some such, you can apply for those things. But I don't believe any of our armed forces today would say, I'd like to finish my house, would that be all right? I don't think that's going to cut it here today. Now, here's the next one, verse 6. Who is the man that has planted a vineyard and has not begun to use its fruit? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in battle and another man begin to use its fruit. Now, in both cases, and you'll see it a third time in the next verse, it's also about another man inheriting it. I don't know how to understand that. I'll leave it to you. If somebody has an idea, I'll certainly be, entertain it here. But lest he die in battle and another man dedicate it, lest he die in battle and another man begin to use the fruit. And in verse 7, who's the man that's engaged to a woman and has not married her? Let him depart and return to his house, lest he die in the battle and another man marry her. Well, I don't know if it's so much about another man does this thing, so much as it is that you, the man that started all of this, are not going to be able to complete it. So it may be that it's just an expression of the day to show your disappointment. Somebody else gets all of your work. So I said, I'm just not sure what it meant in their day, that expression, and I don't know of any place where God elaborates about that expression with, this other man thing. But I suspect the latter and not the former. I suspect it has to do really with the disappointment and then probably just an expression to illustrate it. You will remember, of course, that verse 7 has a corollary. And so if a man marries a wife, how much vacation time does he get from military service automatically? He gets a year. So no man in the first year of his marriage is going to go out to battle anyway. That's the standard to begin with. But now we've got a man who is engaged. He's not married at all yet, but he is engaged. Now, brother, it's kind of humorous to think about this, but I don't mean it humorously at all. How tempted would a guy be to see a battle going, looming on the horizon, say, honey, let's get married? Because also that gives him what? An automatic exemption. Now, could a guy do that? Yeah, he could. He might have bigger problems in his relationship with his Lord if he's going to try to use the Lord's law in such a manner, just for selfish gain like that. But it would be legal, wouldn't it? He could go and do it. He could get engaged then if he didn't want to go to this battle. And sure enough, he'd be let off until the time of over a year later. First, we'd have to get past the wedding. Then he'd have another year's exemption. Okay, and then verse 8, we have a new section there. The officer shall speak further to the people, and they shall say, who is the man that is afraid and faint-hearted? Let him depart and return to his house, so that he might not make his brother's hearts melt like his heart. Now that's interesting. Was like our military service became in October of 1973 an all-volunteer army. I remember that because I went in the Army on September 11th of 1973. And in the middle of my two-month basic training, we went all volunteer. It was October 1973, and suddenly I was in a volunteer army. The draft ended at that time. Okay, so now it's all volunteer. Now guys that would sign up, would expect that they know what they're doing. They would hopefully would have thought it through. They would have contemplated the possibility of combat. They should not have signed up if, they couldn't handle it or were afraid to do it. But was that the case back then? No. Once you turn 20, what? Boy, you're a fighting man. Okay, so it's not even like they had a draft and draw numbers and all the rest of that for those of you old enough to remember those days. It's just a matter of, hey, anybody over the age of 20 is in military service. So everybody's in the service, but do you really want everybody going out to the battle? They will have influence. The faint-hearted can infect others with their faint-heartedness. So just accept it. if you recognize that you don't feel like you can handle this, you're just so afraid you can't sleep at night, you haven't got the courage, well then have enough courage to admit it and not cause a problem for everybody else. And then we'll give you the pass. We don't want you to be a problem on the battlefield. So you will not have to go into combat. And I suppose that's where KP came from, you know, and got the cooks going and everything even so long ago. But I appreciate these laws, don't you? And now, eventually, after the judges, they're going to have a king. And what does he have to write down? These very things. Who, above all others, is going to be sorely tempted to throw every man into the battle? Chicken-hearted kings. Well, you shouldn't do that. Here's the law, and you wrote out a copy yourself. You don't send those that lack courage into battle. Verse 9 is another section. It's verses 9 by itself. It shall come about, when the officers have finished speaking to the people, they shall appoint commanders of armies at the head of the people. So you guys can go ahead and design your own chain of command for your armies. Okay, so here I give you the right. You appoint commanders as you wish. You know, they're given carte blanche here to head up these people. So set up whatever military system strikes your fancy. 10 and 11 is another section. When you approach a city to fight against it, and note, it's a new section on the outline. These are now the rules of engagement. So we're done with rules for preparation. Verse 10 to the end of the chapter are what to this day we consider rules of engagement. ROE, you know, they call them for that purpose. United States, you hear about them all the time. Our rules of engagement do not include what happened at Abu Ghraib. Our rules of engagement do not allow the murder of prisoners. We've got, I think, beyond all doubt, the most civilized, compassionate in the midst of war. What a contrast and juxtaposition that is. Rules of engagement that the world's ever seen. But when you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. Now right there, they are forbidden to just march in and destroy unless God says so. But on left to their own devices, you're going out to sweep everybody out of this land. You got to offer every city conditions for peace. And it shall come about, if it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then it shall be that all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. Now, this is not a contradiction. Can anybody here see why it could be used that way by unbelievers?
This was rules that were in place outside of the territory that they were from.
Okay. See, these people go read ahead and know what's coming. See, yeah. And they know the end from the beginning. Yeah, but that's absolutely right. There were seven nations living inside the boundaries of Israel that had to be what? Exterminated. Every man, woman, and child were annihilated. Same with the livestock. Okay? You had to kill everything living in those seven nations. But this country was going to be larger than those seven nations. The people living in it would be more peoples than the seven stipulated nations. This is pretty critically important, I think, to remember. And I believe I, for one, and I think most people do, we get in the very easy habit, but quite false, of saying they had to kill everybody, you know, in the boundaries of Israel. That is not true. There were seven nations that were named. Those seven tribal peoples had to be killed, but not anybody else. Which was why, later, Gibeah is a fascinating sight to see, by the way. You can look down on it from quite an eminence, and you can see terraces and the remnants of the old city and all of that. A fascinating place to look at, and not far from Jerusalem at all. But Gibeah got away with what? What did they do? They faked that they were from a great distance. They lied that they were not among the people that were supposed to be annihilated. They were, but they lied about it in that particular city. So the Joshua didn't consult the Lord. They made a covenant with them, even though they were not supposed to make that covenant. They were supposed to exterminate these people, and instead, they violated God's desire, and they made a covenant with those people. Even though they'd made a covenant that they weren't supposed to, what did they have to do now that the covenant existed? They had to keep it. So those people became the forced labor that you read about right here. One city was spared by their subterfuge, and I suspect the failure of the leadership not to inquire of God. They fooled them that they were outside these seven nations, made then a covenant that they should not have made. But once they made it, God respects covenants, even if you're not supposed to make it. After you've made it, you don't break it. And we got a divine ruling on that there in Joshua. So they got away with it. But first, with everybody who is not in the condemned nations, you've got to offer peace. Next segment, verse 12 through 15. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When Yahweh your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that's in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourself. Could they do any of those things with the cities under the ban? Well, no. But here, these are not among those seven nations now. You shall use the spoil of your enemies, which Yahweh your God has given you. So in the earlier prophecies, in this book and elsewhere, you're going to get in this land, you're going to get houses that you didn't build and vineyards that you didn't plant and cisterns that you didn't dig. See, you get to keep all that stuff. But for the people and, you know, the livestock in seven banned nations, that's put to death. The other nations, yours to use as you see fit. That's where you get this inheritance. Okay, next stop is verses 16 through 18. Only in the cities of these people that Yahweh your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. You shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Now the Girgashite will be added to that list in other places. So there are seven. Here there's only six, but there are seven that are mentioned. Now with them, verse 18, you utterly destroy them in order that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they've done for their gods, so that you would sin against Yahweh your God. In this boundaries, within the boundaries that I got am stipulating, you must eradicate these particular nations, because if you leave them in place, they will tempt you to their gods. Brethren, this has always been the case. It is the case to this day. It is what is one of the primary responsibilities of every preacher on the planet today, not to allow the ethics of the country that we live among to influence us to abandon the truth. There will always be this war going on. Well, it's not physical anymore, but to this day, brethren, we live in a country that is watering down all things holy. And on what seems like could be nearly a weekly basis, the people that we're trying to bring to Christ, even if they become Christians, are bringing that world's ethics in among us. And if we don't remain ever vigilant, preaching constantly against it, teaching against those things, slowly but surely, we begin to speak half in the language of the Jews and half in the language of Ashdod. And pretty soon, once you start talking the language, you start embracing the doctrines. Once you get so compassionate and patient and long-suffering and diplomatic and politically correct, you wind up Just another denomination teaching that everybody's going to heaven no matter what they believe or practice. So nothing's changed, except that it has become a purely spiritual warfare now, typified, exemplified, foreshadowed, as we see in circumstances like these. So finally we get to the last two verses of this chapter. When you besiege a city a long time to make war against it in order to capture it, you shall not destroy its trees by swinging an axe against them, for you may eat from them. You shall not cut them down. For is the tree of the field a man that it should be besieged by you? Only the trees which you know are not fruit trees you shall destroy and cut down, that you may construct siege works against the city that is making war with you until it falls. Now, brethren, it was very commonly the case in multitudes of nations prior to this time, during this time, and after this time to have what we now call a scorched earth policy. What is a scorched earth policy? Every last thing that is of any utilitarian value is to be burnt. Render everything to ashes and useless. And then, as a matter of fact, you've heard the term, what do you do in the fields? You sow salt. If you went out and sow salt like you would sow seed, what do you do to that field? You completely wrecked it. Now it's sterile. Now it can't grow anything. Okay? That's been the policy practiced, you know, was it Sherman's March to the Sea? Was it Sherman? Who are you, story of Sherman? Okay. And so, you know, we've had that same kind of thing here in this country of ours. Mm-mm. No, you don't do that. Now, you may think it's desperate, and you may have a very long siege, and you may have to go a very long way, but when you guys are done with your siege, every fruit tree is still going to be standing. Okay? Because they have a value for sustaining life. It takes a long time for them to acquire that value from a seedling, so you don't destroy them. And I can imagine this must have been a great temptation, brethren. City after city after city, what soldier wants to go long distances to get his wood? You would think, well, you know, these people, I'm not planning to live here, and we don't want them coming back, the ones that escaped us out into the woods. We'll just burn everything to the ground. No, you won't, if you're going to be faithful to your God. So, only the trees which you know are not fruit trees you shall destroy and cut down, that you may construct siege works against the city, making war with you until it falls. Okay, so there's the end of chapter 20. Any comments or questions there? All right. 21 has, you know, quite a few sections. It's got five sections, but they're all very short, and they're all very, you know, apparent too, really. And so we'll be able to get through it, I think, just fine in 15 minutes. The first section, as you can see there, again, coincidentally, is the first nine verses. When you, 21, if a slain person is found lying in the open country in the land which Yahweh your God gives you to possess, and it is not known who has struck him. Now, brethren, just about 99% of the time, you could tell if this is a natural death or some kind of a murder. Well, now we're talking about a murder. Somebody struck him. We can see that. But we don't know who did it. We just discovered there's the body. Then your elders and your judges shall go out and measure the distance to the cities which are around the slain one. How about this? It shall be that the city which is nearest to the slain man, that is the elders of that city, shall take a heifer of the herd, which has not been worked, which has not pulled in a yoke, and the elders of that city shall bring the heifer down to a valley with running water, which has not been plowed or sown, and shall break the heifer's neck there in the valley. Then the priests, the sons of Levi, shall come near, for Yahweh your God has chosen them to serve him and to bless in the name of Yahweh, and every dispute and every assault shall be settled by them. All the elders of that city, which is nearest to the slain man, shall wash their hands over the heifer whose neck was broken in the valley. They got running water there to do it. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed his blood, nor did our eyes see it. Forgive your people Israel, whom you have redeemed, O Yahweh, and do not place the guilt of innocent blood in the midst of your people Israel, and the blood guiltiness shall be forgiven them. So you shall remove the guilt of innocent blood from your midst when you do what is right in the sight of Yahweh. Now, brethren, the first inklings that God gives us about the value that He places on human life go all the way back to Genesis, what chapter? 4, when Cain kills Abel. And God makes a very powerful point there. And He will repeat it quite a few times in Moses' 5 books and elsewhere. How much value does God put on a human life? If by man His blood has been shed, then what? By man shall His blood be shed. That's the law. And the very ground cries out against that city and that nation that won't do it. Does this nation do that? No. And there's an ocean of blood that cries out from the ground to this day because of our not practicing this law. Now, I know it's Moses' law, and I know that Moses' law is done away in the cross. I'm certainly not denying that at all. But, brethren, there's just as well a death penalty in the New Testament as there is in the Old. There's no change in human beings nor God's value of the human life. And it has for a long time been for me, I suspect it is for you as well, something of an unnerving or at least disconcerting, reality. It bothers me, and I hope it bothers you, and it's a bit fearsome to recognize how much blood is never atoned for in our nation. We have been eroding, capital punishment for the longest time. And, of course, there are whole states that have outlawed it altogether, and effectively it hardly gets practiced anyway, even in states that nominally say they have it. Brethren, this is bad. So if you want to worry about things, that's one of them to be concerned about. And so this one day is bound to catch up to our nation like it is to any other. But look at how meticulously God cared about it. You found a body. We can't figure out who did it. Well, then somebody's going to have to go out there, with their rod and chain, and they're going to have to measure till they find out the nearest city, and sacrifice must be offered. And prayer for forgiveness must be offered. Pray, Lord God, take the blood guiltiness off of us, which demonstrates by a necessary implication that the blood guiltiness was on them. Forgive us of it. Now, that blood guiltiness, brethren, becomes a fact when some member of your society commits a murder. And you didn't see it. You didn't know it. You go find a body that's been laying out in the sun, for 20 years. And for 20 years, that blood guiltiness has been in effect. I don't think for a minute this, the most inherent and central of moral laws, has ever been abrogated at any point in human history. So it's food for thought. God still cares about every human life, and there still ought to be a death penalty, and there still ought to be prayers for forgiveness, when we don't. Well, for a culture like ours, it would, immediately do away with it entirely if they but could. You and I need to be doing some serious praying. Okay, in chapter 21 now, so that's the unsolved murder, in the outline here. Now we've got what to do about wives from captives. When you capture a city that is one of the 7, are there going to be any wives around for you to take? They're put to death. So, this is for those that you capture who are not under the 7-city ban, the 7-peoples ban. Let me say it that way. All right, so here we go in verse 10. When you go out to battle against your enemies, and Yahweh your God delivers them into your hands, and you take them away captive, and see among the captives a beautiful woman, you have a desire for her, and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house. She shall shave her head and trim her nails. You shall also remove the clothes of her captivity, and she shall remain in your house and mourn her father and mother a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. And it shall be, if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes. But you shall certainly not sell her for money. You shall not mistreat her because you've humbled her. You know, you killed her parents, you took her city, and now you want to take her as a wife, and you can. But she's going to have to lose every vestige of the old life. Shave her head, trim her nails, destroy the clothes, you know, and then mourn for 30 days. And when we're done, she can be your wife. But you're not going to treat her just like a slave. What is she now? She's your wife. Okay? You're going to treat her like a wife. Now, in my view of things, since we've been studying marriage and divorce, brethren, I think that every marital law is also going to apply to her. And so, you know, for instance, you're not pleased with her. Well, we get to Deuteronomy 24. We'll find out what to do and why it is and when a divorce could take place. And you're not pleased and can send them away. In the next chapter, which we'll do next week, chapter 22, we'll have further marital laws. We've studied them on Sunday mornings now recently anyway. You know, I don't think, this is my own personal view, but I can't find any statement in Scripture that would put the captive wife in a separate category where you could just dump her if you wanted to. I think she comes under all the legal circumstances in the law of Moses. I can't find any place that would exempt her, so you can just send her, you know, anytime you want. When just said, you've humbled her and you should not mistreat her. You take a woman to wife and then you just throw her away, that's a mistreatment. And you're not even allowed to do that to a captive, let alone the Jewish wives. That we're not going to have. Now, 15 through 17 gives us a polygamy law. If a man has two wives, the one loved and the other unloved, and both the loved and the unloved have borne him sons, if the firstborn son belongs to the unloved, then it shall be, in the day he wills what he has to his sons, he cannot make the son of the loved the firstborn before the son of the unloved, who is the firstborn. But he shall acknowledge the firstborn, the son of the unloved, by giving him a double portion of all that he has, for he is the beginning of his strength. To him belongs the right of the firstborn. This isn't about your wife. It's about your son. So that's the way that it's going to be. Okay? So, of course, we have a number of polygamy laws. Here's one. Now, polygamy, perfectly legal, and so God then stipulates in some detail exactly how that is to work. 18 through 21. If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son who will not obey his father or his mother, and when they chastise him, he will not even listen to them, that is profoundly important. Did the parents exercise proper discipline, yes or no? Yes, they did. And they would have every member of the city as a witness to it. You couldn't hide it. They would know who was a good father and mother who disciplined their children and who didn't. And you would be able to find out those who, by reason of insanity or pure rebellion or whatever, will not respond. Those who do not respond for whatever reason. Anyone. If any man has a stubborn and rebellious son, there aren't any qualifications. If you have one, and you did the discipline, and it did not work, for whatever reason, then his father and mother shall seize him. You probably have to do that if he's a rebellious son. It's going to take, you know, force. Imagine that wrestling match. Bring him out to the elders of the city at the gateway of his hometown. They shall say to the elders of this city, this son of ours is stubborn and rebellious. He will not obey us. He is a glutton and a drunkard. Then all the men of this city shall stone him to death. So you shall remove the evil from your midst, and all Israel shall hear of it and fear. Until we get to America, you know, and then we're so much better than everybody in God's wisdom itself, you know, that we wouldn't even dream of doing such a thing. But brethren, that is as fair, as just, as correct, and reasonable and right today as it ever would have been back then. These people knew that if you let the unfaithful live among you, Then you'll be tempted to their gods and their sins and their ways. And if you let your unfaithful children do the same thing, you're likely to have the same problem. We're going to put an end to that in Israel. So call us cruel and unusual if you want, but you'll also recognize that we have a system of laws that works and keeps this nation far stronger and safer than you'd be allowing these guys to just go on. And then lastly, of course, we have the passage, which, please note, is going to be cited in Galatians 3:13. So you'll want to put Galatians 3:13 in the margin there. So in Galatians 3:13, this passage is going to be cited. If a man has committed a sin worthy of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree. Now, brethren, I think necessarily, and I think as we learn everything else that can be found in Moses' law, they did not practice hanging with a noose to put a person to death, nor did they practice crucifixion, which would not be invented till the Romans, a long time from Moses' time. So when he says, and you hang him on a tree, they did apparently stone people to death, but then hung them up on a tree somehow so that everybody would see this is what you do when you commit a capital offense in Israel, and this is what you get when you commit a capital offense in Israel. There's not a thing in the world, cruel or inhuman, about displaying or even witnessing or participating in the capital punishment. This was required of the Jews. Ergo, if God allowed it, it is not possible for it to be immoral. It's not possible that it could be inherently evil. It's not possible that it could be a sin. God doesn't allow sin. Never does. He's not going to sacrifice his moral principles. So what's apparently happening is they were not crucified and they were not hung. They were stoned. And then they were affixed to a tree. I'm sure not with nails. You tie somebody much more easily and can remove them much more easily. They would have been somehow strapped to a tree on display. And it sure enough would teach people something. Now the last two verses show us a reason why as well in verse 23. His corpse shall not hang all night on the tree, but you shall surely bury him the next day, for he who is hanged is accursed of God, so that you do not defile your land which Yahweh your God gives you as an inheritance. So no matter if this is the most prolific serial killer and rapist and molester that the world's ever seen, do you display his body overnight? You don't do it. Bad as all that is, you're at least going to show enough respect to, you know, the life that God gave him, I suppose, as to bury him. You know, he's accursed already. You don't want to defile the land which Yahweh your God has given you as an inheritance. You let that happen, you're defiling the land, and you'll pay for that eventually.